Hey folks, I want to tell you about a great new sports show from Star Talk, the people behind Neil deGrasse Tyson's hit science podcast, Star Talk Radio. The new show is called Playing with Science. Each episode, pro soccer player Gary O'Reilly and Star Talk Radio's co-host Chuck Nice recruit athletes, experts, and scientists to explore the stories behind iconic moments in sports with guests like Lance Armstrong, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and Hope Solo. Learn about the science behind Steph Curry's 40-foot set shot or the technology that helped Usain Bolt become the fastest human on Earth. In the first episode, Chuck and Gary celebrate the big game with Super Bowl champion players Osi Umenyiora of the New York Giants and Santonio Holmes of the Pittsburgh Steelers, along with astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson. So check it out. All you have to do is subscribe to Playing with Science from Star Talk in iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Awesome show on this Wednesday night edition of the Dunktime Basketball Podcast. A guest who I've long admired, Coach Mike Fratello, now an analyst for the Brooklyn Nets, is going to be on to talk about the Nets. And also I wanted to ask him about some of those Cleveland teams that he played that really slow down style with. And he's got a great story about how they implemented that. Then we're going to get to the Northwest Division. Danny will jump on for that one. Take a look at some of the possibilities there at the upcoming trade deadline. Our sponsors today, Movement Watches, MVMT Watches/CapSpace is the URL to get a 15% discount on a beautiful watch. And CESO, SEESO.com. Use that CapSpace code at checkout to get a month free of laughing your ass off comedy. All right, we only have this guest for a short time period here, but I want to get right to it then with him, as your old partner Marv would say, get right to it. Coach Mike Fratello, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, thank you.
So you have been doing a wonderful job on the Nets broadcast. I still make sure to listen to you guys all the time. It's makes what's been somewhat of a dreary season these last couple of years a little bit more enjoyable to watch. But I wanted to ask you about what you've seen now from the team with Coach Atkinson. How has he changed things relative to what some of the previous coaches have been doing, both in terms of strategy and culturally?
First of all, it's a different agenda now. The previous coaches that were there were all on a let's win right now mode because that was the directive, and that's what you are hired for, is to win games and try to win as many as you can right now. Having said that, this is an entirely new approach to the entire situation, because Sean Marks was brought in as the general manager. Mr. Prokhorov, the owner of the team, along with Sean Marks, have a game plan in place. They understand that there's not a quick fix here. They understand what took place by mortgaging the future to try and win a championship. When they brought in Kevin Garnett, brought in Paul Pierce, they made the moves that they made to try and get that instant gratification that everybody wants in sports. They sold themselves short down the road. They have no draft picks now until 2019, meaning first round draft picks. And the approach is to put a solid foundation, try and put develop a culture that will be a long-term winning culture from the players within the program, and then add the pieces, meaning the players, that fit into the style they want to play, the culture that they're trying to develop, and move forward, and then have something solid built that will have a run very similar to what San Antonio's incredible success has been, because that's the program that Sean Mark played for and then developed his front office skills under R.C. Buford and Greg Popovich there in San Antonio. And that's what is happening in Atlanta right now, with Mike Budenholzer being the 14-year assistant to Popovich, having both front office and head coaching responsibilities, them trying to develop and being very successful at what they're doing right now in Atlanta, looking long-term.
So to that vein, who on this team under 25, I mean, obviously they haven't had the high draft picks, but they do have some young guys here. Who on this team under 25 has impressed you? Which of these guys do you think could be a part of the rotation on this team a few years from now, when maybe they're ready to get back into being more of a contender, or at least a playoff team?
Well, before I answer that, let me go to the opposite end of the spectrum. The guy who is the most talented and the guy who right now would draw the most is Brook Lopez, clearly. But Brook Lopez probably is not going to be around when they get right to the point of being a really good, solid franchise. So having said that, and without having a lottery pick over the last couple seasons that could vault them suddenly, without coming up with a Joel Embiid the way Philadelphia did, they had to wait 2 years before he finally started started playing now for Philadelphia, you have to go out and either try and find free agent guys that weren't signed. You have to get a second round pick from somewhere and hope that they develop. And probably the name that they're looking at right now, saying like, you know what, we like a lot of things about this young guy, is Caris LeVert, the swingman, two guard, small forward, that is very athletic, very long, very little playing as far as his resume goes, because he was injured while at Michigan, played 15 games in his senior season, and you know, up to this point this year with the Nets is right around the 26-27 game mark this season for Brooklyn because of the injuries that he had to his foot. And I think they're looking at him saying, like, this might be somebody that is a rotation guy that we can develop. He's one of the most coachable, fine young men you're going to come across, and they like that because that's what they want to. They want to get terrific players that fit into the culture of being good people, high character, and usually those guys are self-starters. You're not trying to motivate them every night to go out and play hard. They do that automatically because that's what they're about.
Yeah, I've been impressed by his ability to put the ball on the floor. I think he's got a nice first step. I think you said as a rotation guy, and that's kind of how I see him as well, as someone who maybe you can throw him the ball on the backside and then he can run a pick and roll for you. Maybe not someone who's going to have the ball in his hands every play initiating the offense. Is that kind of how you see him ending up at this point, with the caveat, of course, that he's not fully formed by any means?
Yeah, I think the big thing for him is in the remainder of this season and next season, how much does he develop in his ball handling skills and his shot making ability and his decision making ability? And then when you watch that grow and happen, his game may evolve, and then you may be able to use him more. I'll give you an example. James Johnson from Miami. The other night in the game against Brooklyn on Monday night, I saw a completely different player than I'd ever seen in his years in the NBA. And this isn't a guy who's just been in the league 1 year, two years.
He's 30 years old. It's crazy.
And all of a sudden, he's initiating Miami's offense. Not saying he came down every time as the point guard, but if they hit him on a wing, he would direct traffic and start to get the offense going. If they put him in the low post area, he would catch as a post-up guy, and then guys would run their cuts, and he would either deliver the ball or make a post move. From the perimeter, he would take people off the dribble, make the next pass the right pass, and you saw really a well-rounded player that does a lot of things that Eric Spoelstra, the coach of Miami, saw this in the young man, gave him those responsibilities, and it's been a two-way street as far as happiness, because I think Johnson is really excited that he's been given these added responsibilities and put in this different role. But as you mentioned, he's 30 years old, so he's had a while to be in the league, to watch and to understand how do you hang around, how do you help your team win, and he's one of those guys that's all about, you know, the team and winning first. And LeVert may turn into a player that today we look and say, well, he can do this or that, but he may be able to do a whole lot more than we're giving him credit for when we give him a little bit of playing time and experience.
What are your observations on Rondae Hollis-Jefferson's season?
That's a good question, because coming into the season, I think there were very high hopes on this young man, but I don't know if anybody really could have defined what his game is about from top to bottom. He's as good a person as you're going to come across. He's all about team. He's all about playing hard. He had some nagging injuries, which have affected his season. The concern about him was his ability to make shots and how much could he score. I think the coaching staff is impressed with his vision, what he sees on the floor, and his ability to make a pass at the right time that would lead to a score. He was labeled or put into that category of could be an outstanding defensive player, and that tends to happen to guys that you question whether they can make shots or not. But you like their athleticism, and you like the fact that they play hard, and they could be a plus for a team, so you put him in a category like he's either a ferocious rebounder or he's a lockdown defender, but you're hoping he's, you know, Tony Allen, let's say, from Memphis, who for years was noted for his defensive prowess, and they kept hoping and hoping that he would get better at the offensive end of the floor, because he's all about what you want, toughness, playing hard, loving the team aspect, and he's remained in Memphis now. He's had a terrific run in Memphis for these 6 or 7 years that he's been there. So going back to Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, his best days are ahead. This young man loves the game, loves to to work at it. They love him because of all the other things. And for him to be a rotation player and contribute to a winning Brooklyn Nets team, then he's going to have to develop other parts of his game. He's going to have to be able to make that in-between shot. To me, it looks like he's figured out that even though the style of play for the team is to shoot a high number of three-point shots, that's not best for him, and that's not best for the team. So it looks to me, whether they've had a meeting, a coaching staff decision, whatever, that he's pulled back a little bit on the sudden threes that really you don't need to take. They're not the threes that he's left by himself. There's no defender on him, not the threes in transition. So he's not trying to create threes like some people get three ball happy, and they try to create shots that aren't there, and they wind up being bad shots for their team. He's pulled back a little bit recently in doing that. I think it's helped his game and helped the Nets a little bit, and he's one of those guys a little bit in that Caris LeVert area as far as their growth and development remainder of this season over the summer and next year will really determine whether he's part of their future.
Real quickly before we move on, where is he at defensively? I mean, is he at that stopper level yet, or does he have a ways to go?
He's got a ways to go. He's a good defensive player. He has athleticism. He's long, but he has a ways to go. He's not a physical defender where you would say he overpowers guys and takes them out of their game. A part of that is being young, and maybe he respects people too much right now, being a youngster in the league, instead of going after them regardless of who they are and laying the wood on them when he has to and taking the physical approach to combine that with his athleticism. But, you know, that's what experience does. It helps you get better, helps you mature, helps you understand better.
Yeah, so he's got to annoy people more, basically, defensively, like really just get into their airspace. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, most great defenders annoyed people, using your word. The Bruce Bowens, the Dennis Rodman that would go out and shut people down and stop them. They annoyed people, yes.
So you mentioned the Nets style. One thing that I really wanted to ask you about, especially with the way the game is trending, is a coaching stint that you had with the Cleveland Cavaliers, where you had a very unique style, something that we don't see in the league today. And I went back and did a little bit of research on it. You guys played at basically the slowest pace in the league, about even five possessions a game slower in a couple of these seasons than the rest of the league. And you started off, you were playing faster when you had Brad Doherty and Mark Price in there last year. Then when Sean Kemp came in, you kind of ramped the pace up again. But for the middle years, when I think it was kind of Terrell Brandon and to put it nicely, some role players around him, you guys really slowed the pace down. Was that something that was really conscious for you at that time? And how did you go about implementing that system? Because from my understanding, a lot of players don't necessarily want to play that way.
Well, I always felt the players wanted to win. And I think if you have reasons and explanation and you explain that to the players, then they have to make a decision. Do they want to be part of that, join in, or do they not want to be part of that and either be traded or released and go play somewhere else?
Well, so when you had that conversation, when you said, hey, this is why we're going to win, we're going to play slower, like what did you say? Like how were you able to convince them that, yeah, this is actually like what's going to work for us?
Well, what had happened was, and this is a little bit long, but I feel like we have the time to explain it. When I went to Cleveland, I went there with a clear understanding that they wanted to win a championship. And the team they had was the one that lost to the Chicago team, you know, Michael Jordan elevating up over Craig Elo, making the jumper, Jordan pumping his fist 100 times that we've seen over and over and over again, replayed Craig Elo, not included in the group still watching. But that group, I really thought they could win the championship. So when I came in and was hired, they felt that defensively, they had watched our Atlanta teams and how we defended, and they thought if we could get a little bit better at the defensive end, we would have a chance to go back and beat Chicago. What happened during that season was just incredible. Larry Nance, a multiple-time All-Star, wound up having his first injury, serious injury in his career, and had knee surgery during training camp. We were practicing 4 or 5 days. All of a sudden, his knee was swelling up. They performed surgery, and they said he'd be out 2 months, 2.5 months. He'd be able to come back. 45, 50 games into the season, Brad Doherty, 28-year-old, five-time All-Star, winds up with two herniated discs in his back that they do surgery on and ends his career. He retires at 28 years old during that same season. Mance came back to get to the playoffs. We qualified for the playoffs that year, and right before the playoffs, Mance's knee blows up again. They do surgery. He's out of the playoffs. Darby's out of the playoffs while we're practicing for the playoffs. Hot Rod Williams, our first sub off the bench, a 6'11", a forward, breaks his thumb practicing on the couple days in between end of the season and first playoff game. So we went into the playoffs a little bit crippled, and the next season, Mance retires over the summer. Darty was done. He had retired already. Mark Price breaks his wrist, and Gerald Wilkins tears his Achilles tendon. So of the five guys that were the five best players, every one of them had some kind of incredible injury that kind of wiped the season out for them and obviously took its toll. So after the two seasons, everybody was gone. They decided they had to start over again and try and rebuild. And we went out there, and there was that period where we were just trying to get some guys to stick around and try and find the right guy. And we went through an adjustment period there with a Terrell Brandon, Bobby Phills, Chris Mills, Tyrone Hill, Michael Cage, Danny Ferry group that we were playing with. And I just knew that, you know, we tried to, as so many people say, we want to play fast this year. We want to take more shots this year. We want to do
every coach says that, right? Yeah.
Yeah, every coach, every organization, so that the season tickets sell and people sit in the stands and cheer. And they say people like that style of play. I don't know if they like that style of play when they're losing by 30 points, but maybe they like that style of play losing by 30. But so when we start out...
You can ask Paul Westhead and his Nuggets team from a couple years before that about that one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we start out and, you know, we play the first five games and we're 0-5. And in each game, there was a point in the game where the score was like, you know, 87-86 or 91-90. And then in the next 2 minutes, 3 minutes, we would get outscored 15-1, 14-2, and we'd wind up losing the game by significant points. So we broke it down and we put them on big charts, like pieces of paper, everything that had happened. Basically, what happened is we ran out of gas. We didn't have enough depth, and the other teams would just wear us out and then blow us off in the 2 or 3 minute stretch. So we went into the locker room, and the worst thing that happened was when you got into the locker room, nobody could look at each other. The players, they're looking at the ground, they're looking at their hands, they're looking at, when you're losing and you're losing by 15, by 17, but the game was a tie game. The game was a 1 point game, and now all of a sudden we lose by, you know, 16, 17. How is this happening? The players, all of a sudden, if you're competitive, you don't like that. So now they're not looking at the coach when he's talking, they're not looking at their teammates, they're not happy with each other because they're competitors. They want to win. So after five games, we have this big team meeting, and we have the big five big charts hanging up on the walls, taped to the walls in the locker room. And we go through each game one at a time. And I said to him, all right, here's what I'm going to throw out there. I think if we slow our pace down, we control the basketball, we can't turn it over, we have to become the best defensive team in the league. We've got to challenge every shot, no second shots, block it out. The only time we're going to fast break and run is if we get a steal, go. If we get a block shot, we have numbers, go. Otherwise, we're going to make the defenders on the other team have to work for 23 seconds. And you know what? We may get a 24-second violation once a game. I don't care. If we're running our stuff and passing the ball and we just happen to run out of time, I'll live with one possession like that, two possessions like that. But I think we'll break the other team down. They don't want to stay in their defensive stance. They don't want to work for 24 seconds at the defensive end. And we'll get good shots, high percentage shots. I think if we cut the game down, slow it down, we can compete, be in the game, and win close games with execution. I said, but that's my thought. That's my idea. That's my suggestion. You guys are the ones that are playing the game, and you have to buy in it. So having said that, I'm going to walk out of the room. I turned to our captain, and I said, you discuss this with the team. It was Bobby Phills. And I said, you guys decide what you want to do. You want to keep running like we're running, going up and down the floor, and play, and we'll get better, and we'll improve. Or if you want to try and do what I said, I think we stand a chance of winning games. And I said, so just let me know. And I walked out with the staff. We walked out of the locker room. We waited down the hall. A little while later, Bobby Phills came down, and he said, all right, coach, we're ready. We want to try it your way. Let's try it the way you said. So the next night we played, and I can't remember if it was San Antonio first or Indiana first, but they were the two next games. A very good Indiana team, a very good San Antonio team with David Robinson and that whole group. And we lose the first game by like two, I think it was. Go into the locker room, and I look at everybody, and I said, you know what? I said, we were right there with a great team, and we had a chance at the end to win. I said, I feel really good about how you played tonight. And you could see they have like a little life to them that they knew they played well that night and almost beat a terrific team. Well, the next game, well, remember, we're still 0-6. The next game, we play the other team, whether it was San Antonio or Indiana, and the same exact thing happens. We get to the end and we lose like a one-point game. But I went back in the locker room that night and said, we're going to be fine. I said, we are going to be fine. I said, because you took another great team right down to the wire. We had a chance. Now we're 0-7, and I'm in there saying, we're going to be fine. Well, that group went on to win 47 games and made the playoffs that year, changing the style of play, holding opponents to under 89 points per game, and it was about winning. And we had a team that became so close-knit, so competitive. They loved being in every game. They knew that we were annoying other teams because of how we played, because we made them have to defend. And so many times, shots came with 3-2-1 on the 24-second clock, but we didn't turn it over a lot. For our size, we rebounded well. We didn't give up a lot of second shot opportunities. We were tough-minded defensively, and we executed at the offensive end. We went to the guys that we knew could get baskets for us, and they had success. That's what I thought was important. Not the pace of the game necessarily. It was taking a style and putting it with what we had. We didn't have 12 deep back then. We had a few guys that could play and other guys that were kind of the do your role, do your job type thing that helped us to win games.
Yeah, actually, it was San Antonio. I'm looking at the games from that year right now. And you guys lost that one by three. That's a great story about how you got the guys to buy in. I know you're pressed for time, so I'll let you go. I that was a great story. I really appreciate it. And thanks so much for your time, Coach. I look forward to talking again sometime.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
We'll get to the Northwest Division trade preview momentarily. But first, this from CISO. SEESO gets you unlimited access to their original series, Late Night with Seth Meyers the next day, awesome stand-up specials, binge-worthy classics, all on demand and ad-free. They've got British comedies like The It Crowd or Monty Python, 30 Rock, Parks and Rec. CISO has something in its library for you. Old SNL episodes are great. I've been rediscovering some of my favorite old skits on that. And CISO is just $3.99 per month. Far, far less expensive for cord cutters than most streaming services and access to comedy that you can't get elsewhere. You can access it anytime, anywhere on iPhone, Android, Apple TV, any other device for that $3.99 a month. But if you want to check it out, you won't have to pay $3.99 a month. You can go to CISO, SEESO.com right now to sign up for 1 month free with the promo code CAPSPACE at checkout, which is easy to remember. We talk about CAPSPACE all the time on the program. This is the best offer they have going right now. 1 month for free of Laugh Your Ass Off comedy at CISO just by using promo code CAPSPACE. That's CISO.com, SEESO.com, promo code CAPSPACE.
All right, let's get to the Denver Nuggets here. A fascinating team, as you noted in the outline here, because they are buyers, sellers, or both.
They have a big evaluation challenge in front of them already, and then they probably still have a little bit more left with everybody that they have on the team. Young guys, Malik Beasley, Jamal Murray, Jokic is having a wonderful year. But then they also have this older group with Gallinari and Wilson Chandler, and so they need to figure out what they want to do with all those guys. And they also are different because they have cap space. I have them at about $16 million under the cap right now, so they're below the floor with the whole Mo Williams thing and everything else. And they also have picks. They have all of their own first round picks plus Memphis's pick, which is top five protected. So full assumptions is that they're going to get it. And then they have enough second round picks as well. Don't need to go through all the minutia with that unless you really want to, Nate.
Not particularly. They also have Peter Cornelly, the number 53 pick in the most recent draft, someone I know you were impressed by at Summer League. A skinny guy, but lots of length, some bounce, can shoot threes, maybe another guy who could be an asset in a potential trade. And they are of two minds a little bit here. They have Danilo Gallinari, who is going to be a free agent at age 28, although with a rather lengthy injury history. Wilson Chandler, 1 year left on his contract, making about $12 million per season, and then a player option on the end of that. Chandler, just right about his 30th birthday right now. Jarrell Arthur, also an important player for them, but a good defensive
backup big, someone who might have a little bit of value for a team that's trying to contend a little bit more. Will Barton, making $3.5 million a year through next season. Also a guy who maybe a team could try to extend if they were to get him. And then, of course, the perpetually available Kenneth Faried. He's due about $13 million per season for 2 years after this one.
It looks like Jokic is certainly a part of their core moving forward. My hope is
that
we didn't even talk
about Nurkic either, dude.
Yeah.
As another guy who they are rumored to have on the block as a guy who may be, in theory, overqualified as a backup center.
Yeah, he could be. And so the idea with him, and this is true of a couple other teams, is that maybe another franchise can do more with him than the Nuggets can and will pay for that privilege. And Nurkic is cheap for another year. So he's rookie scale this year and rookie scale next year and then is restricted. So certainly valuable in that sense.
Yeah, they have Nurkic is also a little bit of a difficult personality when he's not playing, which he hasn't been very much. They really have too many bigs, but they also don't have any superstar talent on this team. They just have a lot of assets. Maybe Jamal Murray can become that. Maybe Jokic can get close to it. I mean, he's a superstar offensively, I think, already. Defensively is another question. Emmanuel Mudiay, another guy who maybe they might want to move, but it's tough for them because they have so many good pieces, both young and old, that it's really hard to consolidate those pieces into better talent, especially better talent that's on the timeline of some of their young guys. We've heard them rumored to be involved with Paul Millsap, who would be a much better player than anyone on the roster, but he's 32, going to be a free agent, might need a max contract. Maybe they feel like, hey, our long-term books are so clean, we could afford to pay that and have him be a bridge to being competitive while we're still developing these young guys. And Millsap would be a great defensive fit next to Jokic. So they do have these guys, and they've got so many young guys that it's almost at some point, these picks, like, you can't even develop. I mean, Malik Beasley, Wancho, like, those guys would be great to see them playing right now. I think both of them have potential, especially Wancho is impressed in his limited minutes, but they can't even get those guys on the court even now.
Having smaller assets can be a real problem, but one way they could use it, which is not as much at the deadline, is around draft time to move up in the draft using one of those pieces. Let's say you can't get a first round pick for Will Barton. Maybe you can move up 10 spots from that Memphis pick to a maybe a late lottery pick with him, or even a little bit higher than that. That's a way to do it, but it's a little bit challenging to find the right fit of team and everything like that. It's more in the line, I guess, with what the Suns did to get Marquese Chris. Those will be options at that point, but you have to get the right team. You have to get the right fit, and they might end up being a team that just listens, that everyone wants to talk to, but that nothing gets done. But I hope something does.
Their cap situation for next year, even with Gallo's cap hold of almost $23 million, they slate to have about $18 million or so in room. A lot really depends on whether he comes back as well, and some of these guys, Mudiay really is the only guy who's going to need an extension, but he won't even be extension eligible until 2018. This is only his second year. It's weird. It kind of seems like he's been around for quite some time. It's tough too, because they are right now the favorites. They had an ugly loss at the Lakers yesterday, but Jokic didn't play in that one. They are the favorites to get the eighth seed. I know they would really like to make the playoffs after a couple of seasons now in the wilderness. They would just like to get a little buzz in the community, make some money. Certainly they're not a team that does very well financially right now, despite being in a market that's a little bit bigger than they kind of had the reputation for being. So trading guys away may not work that well, but I mean, like, if it were me, I think my plan would be to just try to move on from, I mean, Chandler's value is never going to be higher right now either. I'd forgotten that he's quite as old as he is. But then, what they really need, this is maybe another way to look at this thing, now that I think about it, is they desperately need really good defensive players on the wing and maybe at power forward or as a combo forward if you're going to have Nikola Jokic be your starting center of the future, because their offense has been awesome. They've had like the number two offense since Jokic moved in the starting lineup. And they've also had the blurst defenses.
I agree with your premise, and if you go on that logic, especially as Wilson Chandler gets older, he can help now, but he's not the answer in that way. Gallinari certainly is not the answer. He's a useful offensive player and I think could help a lot of other teams. I mean, I fake traded him to the Cavs for Kevin Love last year when we did the mock deadline pod for a reason, because I think he's a good fit on a lot of strong teams, but not really on this Nugget squad. So what I would do is I would do my best to move Gallinari to the right team, get some good assets back, and listen pretty intently on everyone else with the intention of moving Chandler and Nurkic, just because they're in a situation. And I would probably move Will Barton as well. Barton could be sent in the summer, but trading him now opens up minutes in the immediate for other players that work. And Gary Harris has had a wonderful year, so it's not like you're losing Will Barton is going to throw you down a cliff or anything like that. So I would listen on all those guys, hope that teams fall in love with what you have and that you're open about it. But it's also reasonable to say it's not going to be that kind of a market.
Yeah, Jameer Nelson, another guy that they could look to move to a team that needs a little bit more at backup point guard. You know, if we think about what their future is really going to be, because they have all these guys who are like pretty decent right now, like Jokic is entrenched as the starting center. I think your three-guard rotation of Murray, Harris, and Moutier, you feel pretty solid there. And then they don't really have anything at the three or the four that's locked in. You know, Chandler, they can keep around for one more year. Gallo, they might resign. And just moving on from Gallo, yeah, he's going to be a free agent, but the talk is that he really likes Denver, wants to stay there. So in a team that has not gotten a lot of free agents, doesn't have a great use of some of their other cap space. You know, I mean, I don't know how much you want to commit to him going long-term, because they are going to want to extend a lot of these younger guys at some point, and a real long contract for him could go into that window. But to me, I would be happy to just, and everybody wants 3-and-D guys. That's what they desperately need on the wing at the 3 and the 4. Maybe you could say that Wancho might be their 4 of the future, but, and while he moves his feet pretty well, I don't think he's going to be some great defensive player. They could target someone who's just a more limited, can't shoot type of guy who could develop into a defensive stopper along the lines of Rondae Hollis-Jefferson on another team who's young enough to grow with this core. And they feel like with Jokic at center, with a lot of these other good offensive players that they have, that they can just carry a player like that, because they don't have anybody who even is like remotely a stopper right now on the wing. That might be an option, but you could always go after just sort of like a Thabo Sefolosha in free agency this year too, overpay him a little bit for a couple of years to fill that role out. There just are not a lot of budding young 3-and-D guys who are available. Beasley, even if he were a couple inches taller and a little bit stronger, could project at that, but he's really just more of a 2 in terms of his size. Maybe they're an interesting trade they could look at would be with Atlanta, not necessarily for Paul Millsap, but maybe try to get someone like Taurean Prince, who I know the Hawks really like, but maybe they have enough assets to go after him. And I think just overpay in terms of assets for someone like that, who's would in theory be a better fit. I don't even know if Taurean Prince can play yet, but at least he fits the profile of what I think they desperately need, maybe more than just about any other team. I mean, maybe they could even inquire about what it would take to get Jay Crowder from the Celtics. See if let the Celtics get a little bit bigger. Nurkic is someone who could help the Celtics. They could throw the kitchen sink. I mean, Jay Crowder, and see what if you can get him from the Celtics, because they have the kitchen sink available if they want it.
What do you think about Stanley Johnson there?
Doesn't really fit in with their culture. I do think he's someone that might work in terms of what they need as a fit. We still don't know whether he can hit a shot or not, and he also hasn't reached that level as like a real hardcore defensive stopper. I think he can get there. Yeah, that's a good thought. The Heat love Justice Winslow to death, that's for sure, but we don't know what he's going to be offensively. Maybe there's that might be more of a summer move. Same thing with Stanley. But yeah, those are the type of guys that I think they would be looking at. Or they can just try, and they've got two bullets to spend this draft, so maybe they can try and use those to just keep firing on the 3-and-D guys and see if one of those hits.
OG Anunoby is a completely logical one for them to go after, because he had a knee surgery recently, so I don't know if he's going to be able to work out. I don't know what his timeline is at this point, so they could consider him as well. But I would try multiple times at this. I would do one probably guy who's in the league and one who isn't, because they already have a couple of things that are already well suited. Throw more assets to try to solve the problem early as opposed to having to figure it out late when the team starts to get expensive.
A Nurkic trade, just to kind of calibrate here, I'm going to just throw out three or four of these guys. You tell me what the, just in a vacuum, what you think that they might be worth.
Okay.
Is Nurkic worth the first round pick?
I would say late for sure.
If you're another team. Yeah. Who needs him though? I guess we're not going to go that quick, but.
I would love to see, just because of the team control, what the Spurs could do with him, assuming they expect Dedmon to leave.
Huh. What do they have to send back?
They have a first round pick, I believe.
The 29th pick? That seems like almost not enough at that point.
Yeah, could. I'm just thinking of teams that have late firsts.
And they do only have two centers on the roster right now. They do need a backup center. Jokic is hurt right now. Fareed has kind of been playing as a backup center, but that doesn't work in a lot of matchups, as was shown by them allowing 14 out of 15 shooting to the number 26 ranked offense, the Lakers, last night.
It's not their biggest need, but I bet the Jazz would love to have another rock solid center, because of the whole Favors injury, and I don't know how much they love Jeff Withey, and they have two real late first round picks. I actually have this in my Jazz section as being a possibility in terms of fit.
We mentioned Darrell Arthur as a potential fit for Washington, and matching the salary could be a little bit difficult, but Denver has so many guys who are just can play that would just help some of these depth hungry teams, that maybe packaging some of them together, you could get something that would be pretty good. You know, it's if it were Arthur and Nurkic going to Washington, and then maybe they would take back Jason Smith and some other flotsam.
Jason Smith, who went to the University of Colorado. Or Colorado State.
Colorado State, actually. Yeah, I think Colorado State. Maybe, and he's been playing well lately, so it might not be possible. Kelly Oubre, they just could throw the kitchen sink there. Just say, hey, we're going to give you three guys who can play for Kelly Oubre and maybe another pick. And then maybe we'll give you a little bit of salary relief as well here, Washington. You know, take on like Andrew Nicholson or something, just as dead salary. But yeah, these playoff teams that need some depth. I don't know if there's really anything there with Cleveland necessarily that has anything coming back. All right, well, let's keep playing that game then. So Will Barton, not worth a first rounder to you?
I think on his lonesome, only for the really the right team, but the prospect of having full bird rights on him is really nice if you're capped out like Charlotte, like Washington. That's a huge benefit for them that might not be as pertinent for other teams.
Wilson Chandler.
Late first. I don't think I'd go any farther than that. He has another year on his contract.
Isn't he like a starting small forward?
I think he's on the edge of it, but his injury history scares me, and the idea that he could be fading out. So if you need present value, like a lot of it, I actually really like his fit with Cleveland. They just don't really have the right stuff to trade out, but that would be a way of doing it as well. And God, I keep on thinking of trades with them in Cleveland, but Cleveland doesn't have the right assets to send back unless they wanted to move Kevin Love, which they don't.
If they had like the wing, like the big forward defender version of Amon Shumpert, that'd be great, but Shumpert doesn't help them at all. They got plenty of guys in the backcourt who are probably going to be better than him. And if Cleveland had that guy, they wouldn't need to make a trade to begin with, right?
Nope.
So, you know, the more I think about it, because, you know, Darrell Arthur kind of falls in this category. Gallo, again, probably worth a first-round pick at this point. He's a good player, even with his contract situation. Again, another team that you could get his bird rights, although you have to pay him.
I had a question for you with Gallo. Like, obviously, Toronto wants to go with a better player than him to kind of fill their gap, but how do you think he would fit there for a smaller combination of assets if they can't get Millsap, if they can't get Ibaka?
I think he'd fit great offensively, and maybe against Cleveland, if Cleveland is going small, you could play Patterson and he together, and you're not going to stop anybody there, but Toronto's not stopping anybody anyway these days. He's certainly an upgrade on Damari Carroll offensively, so he could just start at the three for them too in their base lineups, which would be nice. Yeah, I think so. What would come back then? They could ask for Bruno. He's probably not anything too great, but could theoretically evolve into what they're looking for.
Toronto has a couple of picks.
Yeah, they have two picks this year, but again, does Denver really want that much with picks? Maybe it's just, all right, we can combine these and move up as high as we can, just try to do it. But that's something that's tough to do. You know, not everybody is going to do what the Kings were willing to do this year in trading down from 8. You remember Boston tried to throw everything they could to get the pick that became Frank Kaminsky to draft Justice Winslow, and Charlotte, although they probably should have, was not willing to do that. So I think they have so many assets that they're not necessarily going to get full value for all of them to try to consolidate them into the things that they need, whether it's one, the highest pick you can get to just take a swing at a superstar or a really good 3-and-D guy. And the other thing that's coming to mind here about all these is each of these assets individually is not that amazing, but maybe if you have, you can aggregate them together and move them, you could get something that might be pretty good.
Agreed. And that's the hope for any team that builds in this way, that you can combine it or do what Utah did and use basically all of them at the same time because the guys are going
to
get hurt.
All right, let's move on to the Minnesota Timberwolves here. And we spent a ton of time on Denver, of course, because I think they're really interesting. They have all these assets. I don't really see the Wolves doing much of a move other than the rumored trade of Ricky Rubio. But I have to say, despite those rumors, I don't really see that as imminent right now.
I don't either. Minnesota has the detriment that due to the Adrian Payne trade, they can't really trade a first round pick for a while because they have their own this year, but since they have the potential obligation for 2018 through 2020, it's lottery protected. The Stepien rule prevents them from trading this year's pick, and so they could theoretically trade inside of the protection on the back end, but not on the front end. And they owe their first second round pick this year, so they don't have a lot in that way. They do have cap space, and depending on what they do with Pekovic, they could actually have even more. If they get an injury exclusion on him, they could get even more. So that is a nice thing that
they actually do. Just became eligible to apply for that the year anniversary of him last having played. And everything that I've heard about him, so some of his own comments, I mean, he hasn't even been with the team or doing anything. He's been back, you know, working with a European team, not playing, but like in like more of an ownership role. I can't remember exactly who that was. But assuming they get the long-term injury exclusion for him, they have Shabazz Muhammad as their only significant free agent. He's restricted, a cap hold of about $7.6 million. And Gorgui Dieng, they already extended him. He'll be making $14 million next year. So with those on the books, looking at about $28 million in space for this offseason, that includes their draft pick. And if they wanted to move on from Muhammad, then they could get up to about $34-35 million in space. They certainly will be very active in the free agent market. They can open up a max slot very easily if they wanted to move on from somebody. And certainly the 7 to 9 year max is $31 million. So they'll basically have that at their disposal if they want it. But Rubio, again, is a difficult quandary, probably about appropriately paid at $14 million or so over the 2 years after this one. And they also kind of need him a little bit. I mean, maybe a lot of it probably depends too on, does it become clear that they are out of the playoff race once the actual trade deadline rolls around?
I've thought about Ricky Rubio trades a lot over the last little while, especially since the rumors started coming out more full force. And the biggest issue I have with it is just that there isn't really a team in the right place. So teams like the Kings could absolutely use Ricky Rubio. They're very asset poor. They can't make a move work. And other teams are optimistic, let's say New Orleans, that maybe they can retain their existing guy or get somebody else through something else. And so I'm not sure there's a good trade out there right now, though there probably will be in June or July.
Yeah, I think that's right. And Rubio, I think appropriately paid, was not playing very well to start the year. He's looked better lately as the Wolves have started playing better. But the magic that he had, where they always were awesome when he was on the floor and not when he wasn't, that's changed. Chris Dunn starting to come on just a little bit now. They still have Tyus Jones as well. And the reports have been that they want to trade Rubio away and get someone else who can kind of be a bridge point guard to the future. But isn't that what Rubio already is? You know, it doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. I mean, maybe that bridge point guard is a Jameer Nelson, you know, vet kind of guy. But yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, like for the Kings, for example, yeah, they don't really have picks and they don't have any useful young guys. And when you look at what they need, in theory, Dunn is already their point guard of the future. Maybe they can get another bite at that apple in the draft this year. But they're another team that just, they need a really good stretch for. Bielitsa has played a little bit better lately, but probably can use an upgrade there, especially someone who can play some modicum of defense. And then they need somebody who can make a shot on offense outside of their shot creators. And it would really be nice if they had a point guard who could shoot. Dunn is probably never going to be that, which is one reason why I somewhat questioned the pick of him, even though I think he is going to be a wonderful defensive point guard. It'd probably be a top five defensive point guard in the league at some point.
I like Dunn a lot for the parts of his game that are not the most important part of his role description. And that's always hard because it's a very challenging thing to fill otherwise. And they do not have the resources to find a player who can run their offense if Dunn can't do it. They're not going to have that ability. They already have Karl Anthony Towns. He's wonderful. They have Wiggins. They don't have the roster spots. They don't have everything to work. But maybe what they really need is the rest of this year, not only to evaluate themselves, but to figure out what else around the league makes sense for the pieces that they have.
Yeah. Ah, man. If they would have only drafted Jamal Murray.
Yep.
He would be an outstanding fit.
Oh, I actually was going to ask you this off the cuff. We've heard rumors of the Magic being interested in Goran Dragic. Dragic is a great player. I enjoy him a lot. Would you rather have Rubio if you were them than Dragic?
The Magic?
Yes.
No, I don't think so. Dragic, just his playmaking, the fact that his shooting is not a liability. Theoretically, they have other guys in that team who can defend, although they haven't defended this year, but hopefully they can get back to that. So with that being the case, Rubio just has the same problems that Elfrid Payton does.
That's true. And Dragic also, depending on what Miami's circumstance is, it's very possible the price is lower on him just because he's a little bit older and Miami...
The price is lower on Dragic than Rubio?
Well, just relatively. You know, like, because I think Minnesota's probably going to... I don't think they're going to undersell on him now. Later on, probably. But right now, I don't think so. And if Miami just kind of sees the writing on the wall with where their season's going, maybe they turn it a little bit. Not saying overall value, but just over the relative.
And it depends what they can get into free agency this summer, too. If they feel that they could make, you know, get two $20 million a year players by dumping Rubio, and they think those guys are really going to help them, then that might be an idea. What about the other pending free agent that they have? Shabazz Muhammad has played better this year, not a committed defender, but has some tools, hitting the three ball really well, probably more of a bench scorer type than a starter. But you could think, hey, we don't want to pay this guy, might want to get something back. But is he going to get you a first rounder? That seems questionable also. And at that point, again, like so many of these players, it's, well, let's just hold on to him, see what we got to pay him in restricted free agency, and just let that be the plan instead of just giving him up for something that's not going to make a difference. Like, they have enough young guys already, like another second round draft pick, even if it's a decent one, probably not doing much for you.
There also isn't really an additive to have that. So second round pick plus something that changes the calculus too much. And again, he's another guy that would be great on a team that does not have cap flexibility, so they can really wield that restricted free agency cudgel and do a good job with it. I don't know who that is.
How about Tyus Jones? They are in a little bit of a weird spot with him. He clearly is good enough to be playing right now. He's the youngest of their three point guard options, but they also really want to hold on to him because they might trade Rubio instead, and then they need a backup point guard.
He's the Rashawn Holmes in the Philly big men situation.
That's a great analogy. Yeah.
Where you're probably going to keep him because you expect to move one of the guys above him. That's exactly what I would do unless a team makes you a really nice offer. But like, let's say someone came calling, I'm just viewing an abstract valuation, with like the 24th pick in the draft, something in that range. Would you consider that
pick
for him?
That he was selected with, exactly. Ironically enough.
Would you consider that? Or is that just too low considering he's already shown that he can play?
I think I like him more than most people do. So I don't know. I mean, like, he's what you're trying to get with that 24th pick. And it's not like they are running out of money where they have to push the timeline back a little bit. So no, I don't think that would do it. You could say that maybe he would be part of a larger package that they could move to try to get someone else who's going to help them. But I don't really think of any of the guys that are on the market or that the teams that are looking to move those guys kind of need a backup point guard either. You know, I think that Wilson Chandler could be a nice fit there, and being under contract for another year could be useful for Minnesota. But I don't really think that Denver would really want to take anything that Minnesota has to offer.
Makes sense. Just so I can set my own mentions on fire, if I were Tom Thibodeau, I would also gauge interest in Andrew Wiggins just to get an idea. I probably wouldn't trade him now because he still has a really high ceiling. But for me, the core of this team is Karl-Anthony Towns, and that's it for right now. And so Wiggins will probably stick around just because he's good enough and it's hard to get fair value for him. But I would certainly see and listen. And if a team made a huge mistake, I would consider moving him now.
Yeah, Wiggins actually blocked a shot yesterday, or maybe that was 2 days ago.
I think it was two days ago.
So there's a little progress. He like jumped in the air and his hand made contact with an opponent's shot, preventing it from going into the basket. It was impressive. Let's move on to OKC. But first, this word. For about 10 years, I was one of these people who said, what do you need to watch for? You've got your cell phone, you're carrying that around all the time. Just look at that to tell what time it is. But of course, a watch isn't just simply about the practicality of telling what time it is. It actually makes you look like a real adult to have one. Now, having hopefully evolved into being a real adult, I was glad to have been introduced to Movement Watches. MVMTwatches.com/capspace is the URL to get started with them. And their watches start at just $95. I struggled to find a watch that was actually affordable. That's part of the reason I didn't get one. I thought it was a waste of money, but that's because the watches that I liked were like $500. Since Movements just start at $95 and they look fantastic, that really changed the game for me. I'm looking actually at their list of watches right now at that MVMTwatches.com/capspace URL. The Voyager in slate looks like just an awesome watch. I have the gunmetal sandstone. That's a leather band. I might actually get this slate one too, because that's a metal band that's has some more versatility at certain times. They really have a wonderful selection. They've eliminated the middleman, so you don't have to go into a department store and pay way more than you really should, way more than what goes into the watch, just so you can pay for all their overhead. I think if you go to that MVMT watches, movementwatches.com/capspace URL, check out their selection, check out how affordable they are, especially when you get a 15% discount with that /capspace URL. It's easy to remember because we talk about capspace all the time on the program. I think you'll see what I'm talking about. Join the movement. All right, OKC, they're in an interesting spot right now. I'm not sure just overall as a franchise what the way forward is for them now that they have extended all these guys, Oladipo, Adams. They're not going to have any space this summer. In fact, they project as 20 million over, and that's only including cap holds for Roberson and Laverne, plus their first round pick. They're almost going to be trying to avoid the tax at this point. Ennis Kanter is out. He was a key part of the limited amount that they're able to do on their second unit. Their second unit has gotten completely destroyed these last two games against good competition, obviously Cleveland and the Spurs, but without Russell Westbrook in the game, they just can't do anything offensively. Perhaps they might want to make a smaller move just to pick something up to provide a little scoring off the bench, but due to their draft pick situation, they don't really have much in the quiver in that regard.
They are incredibly asset poor. They have a pick that's owed to Utah as a part of the Ennis Kanter trade. It's lottery protected from 2018 to 2020. And then they, in the Jeremy Grant trade, put a top 20 projected first for 2020, depending on when the Jazz pick conveys to 2022. So functionally speaking, they can't trade a first round pick right now. They don't have their 2017 pick, but they can trade seconds moving forward. And as you said, they don't have much cap flexibility. They have actually cap space this year. I believe they still have the option of either using the $7.4 million trade exception from the Ersan Ilyasova trade, or about $7.2 million in cap space. Either way, just depending on how they want to structure the deal for whatever purpose. Yeah. But they don't want to get long-term money probably unless it's the right guy, because they could be a tax team next year. So they have all this stuff going, and then I felt Joffre Laverne was superfluous with a lot of what they have, but now they need him, so they can't trade him either. Anthony Morrow is the only player that I feel on their roster really makes sense to trade right now. He's completely marginalized. There could be some teams that think they can rehab his value, but you're not getting much for him anyway.
They really would like to get off a Kyle Singler's contract, $4.6 million next year, $4.9 million the year after that, then a non-guarantee mercifully in 2019-20. That could help their tax problems for next year. There are teams that really are trying to to get to the salary floor this year, but they're still not going to want to take on those other 2 years probably without a sweetener. And as you mentioned, not really much in the way of sweeteners available on this roster. They could trade their 2017 pick once it's actually made, but that obviously can't occur until the draft. And they could try to move Jeremy Grant again. Andre Roberson, I think that Grant, in a lot of ways, Grant more of a combo forward defender than a guy who can really defend 1 through 4 the way Roberson can, or at least 1 through 3.5 the way Roberson can. But Roberson is going to be a free agent. They were not able to agree with him on an extension. Small cap hold, but where they are tax wise might not make sense to keep him around. When you consider the lack of shooting elsewhere on the roster, it may not make that, and the fact that they like to play with two bigs a fair amount of time, he's a guy that maybe could be traded. And actually, maybe he would make a little bit of sense in Denver as the type of guy that they could target as just an all defense guy that would work with all these offensive players that they have there. And Denver has some guys who could probably help them this year if they wanted to go in that direction. I should have thought of that actually when we were kind of running through the guys. I mean, Roberson is way more limited than some of the guys that could really help him, but I think Denver was playing Alonzo G earlier because they just were so desperate for defense and some guys were injured. Roberson at least is like really good on defense instead of just like kind of good.
It's an interesting thought, but it also, remember that Oklahoma City is pushing a lot on being good in the immediate because Russell Westbrook did sign an extension, but that only added 1 year and he got a huge pay raise. So
He's grandfathered into the designated player. So sure. Probably difficult to imagine that he's not going to stick around, especially because the 5th year that they'll be able to offer him is right around like age 33, 34, and it's going to be like well over $40 million. So yeah, considering that, it makes almost too much sense for him to do that, but maybe he's just made so much.
Right, like that. So I talked about this with Audie Joseph on Real Gym Radio that's going to come out at some point in the next couple of days whenever I get the chance to edit it. And my point with that was he's made a lot of money, and we have a pretty good idea right now of what this Oklahoma City team is going to be. They're more so than almost any other team that's out there. Like, he knows who he's going to play with, he knows who he's going to play against, and so if that's good enough for him, if he wants to be that guy, he certainly can be. But almost anybody would clear the space necessary to get him if that's what he wanted.
I do think it would help them to improve. Roberson, if they were to, and I don't know if Denver would be interested in him or not, but it's the what makes it difficult though is that Roberson makes less already than anyone they would be getting back from Denver, and any salary that they're going to send out to match. I mean, I guess Morrow expires, that would be okay. Nick Collison, they wouldn't want to trade. Singler would be bad salary matching. Josh Huestis hasn't played a single minute in the NBA this year. So it's difficult if you're going to, I mean, I think Darrell Arthur would be awesome for them, right? Like I think he would really help them, his shooting and defensive value. And even someone like Gallo would be very, very helpful, but then they would have the issues with the tax concerns. I don't know that a free agent to be Roberson is enough to get Gallo back. I don't know that, and Hernan Gomez would be another guy who would be great in their system, but I don't know if I would trade Hernan Gomez for Roberson at this point. And it's just, Denver has a bunch of sweeteners that they could throw in, but it looks like whoever they'd be getting back that's going to help them this year, that would be enough for Roberson. Then Oklahoma City would have to throw in a little bit more because they would also have to be sending some bad salary back with Roberson. And that's where maybe the deal gets short-circuited because Oklahoma City doesn't have anything in the way of sweeteners.
I agree with that thought process. I don't really see a way to make that work with the way that we're valuing players, but it's also important to note that they might value them a little bit differently.
Yeah, that's true. And a Will Barton could be useful for Oklahoma City as well. Another guy who could create a little bit, although he's a little redundant with Oladipo. Wilson Chandler, of course, could help them a ton too. But yeah, it's just what they have to send back. If it's just Roberson, I'm not that much of a believer in Roberson that I would want to give up on any of those guys really that we're talking about, unless it were like Darrell Arthur. And that's not enough for OKC's standpoint. Mm-hmm. Maybe like Barton and Arthur, and then you could try to make the salaries match by throwing in Morrow and Collison or put in Huestis because he's not making anything, something like that.
Did you see the guy that I threw in there as a potential flyer for them just because his value is really low right now?
Yeah, it wouldn't be the first bad trade for Orlando that has been made between OKC and Orlando.
Right, there's a relationship between Hennigan and Presti. Mario Hezonja has not been a part part of Orlando's present, maybe not a part of their future. And taking a shot on him would be useful for OKC, considering how few arrows they have in the quiver. The problem is, I'm not sure they have an arrow good enough to make that trade even happen.
Yeah, Hezonja actually played a few games while Fournier was out and didn't do anything, just shot poorly and was again out of the rotation now that Fournier has returned. Yeah, I don't think that OKC has anything to give up that Orlando would really love. But yeah, just getting another guy who can score. I mean, they just need shooting so badly on this team. Like, if they just get some shooting, they could be a 50-win team again with Westbrook playing at this level. Like, a real 50-win team, not like a 48-win team that has a point differential of like 0.1 the way they've gotten lucky in close games this year.
Yeah, I think we're pretty much on the same board. Ready to move on, or you think that there's more on this on them?
I don't think so. And my instinct would be that they're not going to do anything.
Same.
At the deadline. Portland, another team that is kind of in cap hell right now. We've talked ad nauseum about some of the signings and re-signings that they made this past off season. But you want to give a rundown of where they are from a draft standpoint, maybe an asset standpoint outside of their core guys?
Draft standpoint looks rosier. They have all their own first round picks, plus they have Cleveland's 2017 first unprotected, which might actually look a little bit better now that they're not focusing as much on the regular season. And they do not have their 2017 second, but they basically don't have a lot of their own picks moving forward, but they have a 2018 swap potentially with Sacramento. And then they have, actually Sacramento has the swap, sorry, wrong way. And then they're going to have a middling, probably second round pick in 2019. So not bad there, considering they're good on first round picks, and that's far more important. As you said, they're going to be in cap hell. And a point that I wanted to make very briefly with them, which is so unusual, is that their cap situation doesn't look great moving forward. But you could make a very good argument that at this moment, all five of their starters are on good to great contracts. And that combination of good contracts for your starters, but still in cap hell, is exceedingly rare.
Yeah. Well, the Bucks could be starting to get close to there too. Detroit even as well. They don't really have any flotsam in their starting lineup, and they're looking at potentially a tax bill as well. Let's run down a little bit more about some of the cap minutia. CJ McCollum, there's been talk that he and Lillard should be split up. I've not agreed with that, but even if that were to happen, it functionally almost certainly would have to wait until the summer, because the way it's set up with McCollum having gotten a lucrative extension, he would count as the average of this year and the rest of his extension for the receiving team, but outgoing, he only counts at his $3.2 million amount this year. So basically, a team that took him would have to take him into cap space, essentially, or they would have to find a third team, and Portland would not be able to take back hardly any salary in return, and presumably anyone that they wanted would be making money. So if they're any good. So that's really not possible to trade him until the summer. I don't think they should anyway. Azeli is non-guaranteed for next year. He could make some salary filler.
He has $1 million guaranteed for next year.
Yes, thank you. Yeah. But then that gets him into the luxury tax hell, and some of the contracts that they have in their books, just to run it down. Lillard's making 26 for this is for next year. Crabbe 18, Turner 17, Myers Leonard 10, Mo Harkless 9.6, Aminu 7.3, McCollum 24, Ed Davis 6.3, etc. And then Mason Plumlee, a restricted free agent, $5.8 million cap hold, but probably someone who's going to require, if they want to re-sign him, at least $15 million. He'll be asking for more than that as a guy who started at center the last 2 years to some effect. And before you even get into re-signing Plumlee, they would be $31 million over the cap, $12 million over the tax, and almost $22 million in tax paid. That's before you bring back Plumlee. You re-sign him for $15 million. Just entered the numbers into my spreadsheet. Oh, yeah, $27 million over the tax, $73 million in tax paid. And that's assuming that they move on from Azili. So probably going to have to do something for a team that's pretty middling right now in the standings, hoping to get the eighth seed and taking on more salary for next year. I know Paul Allen is willing to pay, and reportedly part of the reason they matched on Crabbe was because Allen was willing to pay and didn't want to lose these assets, but they're going to have to dump salary, and who is that going to be? Turner is very overpaid. He started playing a little bit better. Maybe you could convince someone that he's, you know, an $8, $9 million a year player with how he's been playing lately. Crabbe shooting the ball really well, but that's about all he does. He cannot be traded for a year after he was matched as a restricted free agent unless he consents to it. And cannot be traded to the Nets at all for a year until that's until July. Who else are they going to dump here? And then the other guys who they might move who are making anything, those guys are like good. They're part of the team. I mean, Leonard and Turner would be the two guys I'd be focused on moving if I were them. I mean, maybe they could just dump Noah Vonleh, but he's only making $3.5 million. It's not something that looks great. And then when you consider too that with all the money that they're paying, they don't have any backup big really other than Ed Davis, who's been hurt a little bit recently with his ankle, who can play that much. They don't really have any big man who I would say is above average. They don't have anybody who can be a great threat on the wing and also defend at the 3 and 4 positions. Harkless is an okay shooter. Aminu can't make anything. Turner can't make anything. So they have these big holes I'm sure they would love to try and fill. I mean, maybe what it just has to be is they try to say, hey, you know, what's the cost to get rid of Evan Turner? That's really the question I wanted to ask you now that I've rambled so long, is how many of these draft picks or other assets, and I don't know that any of these young guys who are on rookie contracts or anything are going to help in this matter. How much does it take to get off of Evan Turner or Myers Leonard?
Evan Turner, it's a lot, because there are not teams anymore. This is the sea change that happens with the Sixers actually being better, is that there is not a team that is an empty vessel for cap space anymore. The Sixers want to use their money to improve, especially with the change in management. They're going to want to do that. So there is not a place to send that JaVale McGee contract of $10 million for 2 years. I think it's going to take multiple first-round picks, unless it's a really, really good one, and the Blazers wouldn't want to give that up.
Let's say one of their picks is like number 15 and that Cleveland is number 27. You combine those, is that enough to take on 3 more years of Evan Turner at $17.5 million per?
I don't think so. No.
No. I mean, think of it this way.
Maybe if I were like Orlando or like a team that I didn't think was going to use their money, they'll use it well, maybe. But even then.
Well, think of it this way on Turner. He is probably an $8 million a year player. Would you say that's fair? In the conception of the league, I think he's probably worse than that, frankly, in my opinion. But in the conception of the league, is that fair to say he's an $8 million a year player?
Thereabouts. Sure.
So that's $9 million a year in kind of dead value. And so $27 million total. Back in the day, a crappy first round pick would basically buy you the ability to move about $10 million a season in dead salary. Now, the salary cap is 50% higher. So maybe with inflation, you could think a first round pick allows you to move $15 million in bad salary. Turner kind of equates to about $30 million in bad salary when you compare how much his production is to how much he's actually being paid. So maybe 2 first-round picks is like kind of right about in the range, because he's not terrible. He can at least be in your rotation on the right.
But something to remember here, and why I don't think Portland's going to do it, is because they're not gaining anything from this other than lowering their owner's luxury tax bill. They're not getting better.
Oh yeah, no, I agree. I don't think that. Well, and then they just have a little bit more flexibility going forward as well.
Get a big ass trade exception, but they're probably not going to use a ton of that.
Yeah, that's possible too. And I'm not saying that they're necessarily going to do this, but I thought it was an interesting exercise to just think about, all right, what is it in this new economy here, what is it really going to take to get off a salary? Because there are some bad 2016 contracts and those go out for a long time.
And that's what I wanted to get into also, is the horrendously unlucky, whatever you want to say, timing with the Myers Leonard deal. Because in any other year, really, even with the uptick in salaries, having a flawed but young $10 million a year center would not be the worst thing in the world. But now there is such a glut, such a surplus, and he hasn't had a good year, that it's the worst time to have him.
Yeah, and basically his resume at this point is 1 year where he shot 40% on threes on a pretty small sample. He's been around, he was, I think, in the low 30s last year. This year, he shooting 34%. And when you consider he does nothing else, he never shoots around the basket. He can't play anything other than 5 defensively. And even at that, he is stretched because he's not really a rim protector, can't move his feet in pick and roll defense, not really a smart defender. So all he's giving you is the ability to maybe spot up. He's not even really that great of a pick and pop guy. He's more just a pure spot up guy. Is he even an adequate backup center right now? Maybe you acquire him hoping that he can do that. But again, I think of him as probably giving you $3.5-4 million a year of production right now. He's like in between being a second and third center right now.
And paid like a backup center, like a pretty good backup center.
Yeah. So I don't know. And we haven't even talked about like them actually getting better, right? Like now they have defended better since Aminu returned, since the last month and a half or so, but their offense has really dropped off because Aminu can't hit a shot. They're playing Turner a lot in the starting lineup. They're playing Vonleh, who is useless offensively. Maybe this thing of him starting is partially related to his trade value, but I don't think he started last year.
He's not helping himself.
Wasn't worth anything then either. No, he isn't.
You don't boost it just by getting starts on your resume. I don't think there's any team right now that goes, hey, look, he's starting on the Blazers. Let's pay him a bunch of money, even though he hasn't been good.
By the way, this is pretty funny. You remember how like Jake Layman went 5 of 5 on three-pointers in that early season game in garbage time against the Warriors?
Yes.
He's made 4 out of 33 three-pointers in all other games besides that game.
Wow. He looked so good.
Yeah, well, the hair and the beard will always look good, even if the shot doesn't go in. Yeah, and we haven't even talked about how they're going to like actually get better. And you mentioned a target, Nerlens Noel, all capital letters, please, doesn't necessarily fit in with what they like from a character standpoint. They would have to, again, probably pay the farm to re-sign him. And if they, maybe they could say, hey, we'll offer you both of our first round picks this year, and you can take back some of our bad salary, and then we'll get Nerlens. Maybe that's like how things might match up. But then Philly would have to send something else out too there. Maybe it could be like Ersan Ilyasova, but Philly's playing well. They're not going to want to give up guys who are good.
They could do Sergio or something.
Sergio Rodriguez would be fine, making $8 million this year, something like that, to match up with. And I'm sure Philly has little interest in taking back Evan Turner. That's probably for sure. But yeah, I don't know. I don't see them doing all that much of anything just due to these crazy tax concerns. And they still seem to think a lot higher of a lot of the players on their roster than I think is necessarily warranted at this point.
They also have the problem with the Sixers of the players on Portland's roster aren't particularly good assets for Philadelphia, because Ed Davis is a good basketball player. Ed Davis has no value for the Sixers because he plays the same position as every other guy on their team. So that's not particularly helpful. Maybe they could turn him into something else, but not a huge benefit. So trying to make that, instead of making it 2 firsts to try to unload a bad salary and get him, it's hard to make that side of the ledger different to make it still passable for the Sixers.
Let's go to Utah now.
Utah's fun, but they're probably not going to do anything. But as an intellectual exercise, they might be my favorite team to deal with this, for a basic reason, which I can explain.
Yeah, well, sure.
They, as far as I can think of, they are the only team in the NBA that has the combination of low and middle assets. So they have 2 late firsts. They have a mid-second, a late-second, and they have cap space. They're probably going to use that cap space, hopefully, to renegotiate and extend either George Hill or Derek Favors. But that combination of things, picks, space, and capable players on their roster, means that theoretically, other than a trade for a superstar, which would require one of their other guys, they could do almost anything. I don't think they will, but they could.
I have them at $13 million, a little over $13 million under the salary cap right now for this year. So they could certainly take on some salary for this year. They probably will want to, just to reach the salary floor and save a little bit. Although, hey, it couldn't hurt to engender a little more goodwill with all the guys on your roster to just pay them extra with the salary floor payment to get there. Below the salary floor right now, they are $4.2 million below the salary floor. So that would just, if they don't add any salary, that would just get distributed to their roster, and also might make sense for them to just save up some money now. And they could be facing some potential luxury tax concerns down the road. This summer, Gordon Hayward, $24 million cap hold, George Hill, $12 million cap hold. So they could have some space. Rudy Gobert's extension kicks in at around $25 million a year, 4 years, $102 million, I believe, for him. And that will probably eliminate all of their salary cap space if Hayward to return. If he doesn't, that's another problem. They obviously are going to really try hard to win this year. They're in position to be the fourth seed. They have been playing a little bit worse of late. Derek Favors coming down with more somewhat mysterious knee issues. Don't know if he's ever going to get right this year at this point. Hasn't played that well when he's been out there. with that being the case, what do they need for this year? They have so much depth. The only thing that comes to mind for me is a better defending stretch four option than they already have with Lyles and Dia, assuming that Favors is not going to really be able to be a huge force for them.
I have three needs for them. The first one you just articulated very well. Second is a more rock solid backup point guard. They have guys that are options, but if they could get somebody better, especially if it's somebody who's cost controlled for beyond this year, that would be perfect. And if Favors isn't going to be the guy, I mentioned this before, I think it was in Denver's, they would be a logical destination for a backup center. And so I compiled a list of guys for them with the mentality. I went through all the rosters because I wanted to do this before. Also, I believe Utah is one of the teams I have for the mock trade deadline. That shouldn't spoil anything for anybody. And what I was looking for them was players who are good enough to be like a low-end rotation player this year and moving forward, and have team control, cost control for next season, ideally more than that, but really for those two seasons. And I, again, that's part of the reason why I find the Jazz interesting, is because they have all these kind of like low-end assets, and so a lot of it would just be which teams value their players that way, but they're players they could at least call on.
Yeah, they do have these guys that you could look at as potential trade assets because they have a lot of redundancies. I don't think that Dante Exum would get moved if he were to until the summer. I think there's another team might want to just say, hey, let's give us a year of him to put the ball in his hands and see if he actually can fulfill that promise of being the number five pick. Maybe Utah will say, all right, it's not going to work out for him here. We've re-signed George Hill this summer, but if they could potentially lose Hill, he's unrestricted. Who knows how much he's going to get on the open market. You can't move on probably from Exum yet. He still is someone that they believe has a lot of potential even after the torn ACL. It's just been tough for him when they're trying to win games and they have all these other playmakers on the roster to really spread his wings a little bit. So I wouldn't see him necessarily getting moved. You mentioned Alec Burks. He's looked good lately. A guy who could provide a lot of offense penetration for teams that are really scoring poor in the backcourt. More really of a one position defender, Burks, as you know, at the two, so it's tough to really play him as a three with a couple of other smaller guards, but certainly someone who would have value to a team. And if you're Utah just in a vacuum, what are you looking for in exchange for Alec Burks? I think draft picks don't do him a ton of good at this point. They've got plenty of those coming already. What would do it for you for Alec Burks?
Someone who can answer one of their other questions and basically just fills a bigger need for them. I don't believe in Trey Lyles as much as other people do. So if you think Trey Lyles is the answer to their point guards, to their power forward situation, then hey, maybe you don't need a power forward. But otherwise, getting somebody who's there and who has cost control is a very important part of this for them. You know, you don't want to get Ersan Ilyasova, for example, who is a good player, not a perfect fit, because he's a free agent after this year. You'd rather get somebody who fits in a little bit differently.
Yeah, and they still have Boris Diaz. While he may end up being the guy that they play, I still want to see him play Hayward at the four as well. Burks is in the rotation now. He's been helping them, so they're trying to be good. Don't know if you'd want to move on from him. Jeff Withey, they probably are going to need as a backup center this year. He could maybe help another team as a guy who can just protect the rim, not a very good finisher, limited offensively. But if Favors can't be completely relied upon, then they probably need to hold on to Withey just to play a few backup center minutes when Gobert is out of the game, because you can't roll with Dia and Lyles together on your second unit defensively. That's going to get destroyed.
Utah also one thing I want to mention with him with Withey is the reason you would probably move him is if you've used one of your other assets to get an answer for the question that he was trying to answer. So if you get a different center, then you trade Withey for a small asset to try to recoup some of the cost that you incurred to get the other guy.
They have these point guards too, Mac and Neto. Mac will be unrestricted this year. Neto has another non-guaranteed season after this year. Then he'll be a restricted free agent. He's a guy I'd like to see get more of a chance as a backup point guard. Mac, we know what he is, but there's been talk that maybe a team like Cleveland was interested. A second rounder that's not completely terrible would probably do it for me, for Mac. But I mean, that assumes that Burks is back and now he's just going to be your backup point guard. And it's tough because they have these guys who are theoretically surplus, but they have enough injury questions and then enough questions about guys potentially leaving in free agency that it's hard to trade away from that surplus, because then you could not have a surplus all of a sudden 6 months from now.
It's a good point. I want to throw a couple of different ideas that I had at you. I'm not going to throw everybody because that's no fun, but different players that I thought of, and you can tell me if you think they're worth one of those assets. So to clarify, they have their own pick in the first round. They have the Warriors pick. So those are both probably going to be their pick mid-20s, Warriors pick 30. And then they have a middling second round pick. So I'm gonna give you some names. Would you take any of those assets for Terry Rozier?
If I were the Celtics, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah, I think so, especially when you consider that they are going to be trying to clear absolutely as much space as they can. If they could draft and stash a guy, that might be something. But what does Utah want with him?
Backup point guard, a better bite at the apple, cost controlled for a couple of years.
Okay.
Tyler Ulis, same basic logic for the role, but I think he's probably a little bit lower on the poll, at least maybe to me.
Yeah, that's an interesting one, although I want someone who can't be taken advantage of defensively on the second unit, because when Gobert is out of the game, it's looking like they actually are really bad defensively. So I don't know if that's an interesting flyer. I know, do we know that he's better than how old Neto is? He probably is a little bit, maybe. Neto's better on defense, but Ulis is a better offensive player.
Probably has a higher ceiling and has cost control for another couple of years. So I think that would be worth it. And then on the big man one, I didn't really have any great fours for them, but the guy who I just zoomed in on was Rashawn Holmes. Holmes is cost controlled for this year and next year, would be a nice backup center for them. They wouldn't need to be asking a lot of him. And I can't, the Sixers really like him, but I can't imagine that they would turn down like even that the 30th pick. Like that would be a lot. That would be a lot for Rashawn Holmes. I think that might even be too much.
I'd turn down the 30th pick for him, I think, but that's I probably have a higher conception of him than a lot of people. I mean, Holmes is a decent backup center right now. He's not making very much for the next 2 years. Isn't that what you're like trying to get with that pick? You're just hoping that maybe it could become that. You know, I'm not really sure. And he's young, so I don't know that I would necessarily do that deal. And they have a lot of bigs too. I think they just, it's just tough for Utah because they've been healthy so little. They've got these guys, Favors and Burks, coming back from injury. I mean, they could lose Gordon Hayward. They could lose Hill. They've got these free agents in the offseason. Favors could be gone after next year. They're going to try to renegotiate and extend Hill. Maybe they won't be able to do that. They've got so much in flux that it's tough to make a deal right now for that reason. I mean, this is their first year being good too. Like, it's just, we're good now. Do we want to really move on from people again? Like, let's just let this group actually see what it can do for 1 year at least.
It's fair. But at the same time, this is their best shot, you know, for a lot of these things, because if they're going to be capped out next year, you lose so much flexibility the second that happens. And so even if it's a cheap guy, it gets a lot more complicated. If you like what you have and you don't have trade exceptions, it gets a lot harder to add somebody, even if you're trading a pick for him.
All right, I think that'll do it. We will be back tomorrow, finish out the trade deadline previews, then over the weekend, the mock trade deadline with Dunked On Stalwarts, Kevin Pelton, and Dan Feldman, who probably have a lot better adjectives to attach to them than Dunked On Stalwarts. But for our purposes, we can call them that. Don't forget about our sponsors today. Movement Watches, MVMTwatches.com/capspace will get you 15% off an awesome watch. And then CISO, that capspace code, gets you a month free of some awesome comedy. Talk to y'all next time.